There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing together the best bits of today's show from Monday, January the 20th.
All this week, you're going to hear a lot of yodeling. And that is because the great and the good are gathering in the Swiss ski resort of Davos for the World Economic Forum. Officially, it begins tomorrow, but the conversations have already started in the corridors of power. And the big talking point, Brandy Scott, is our top story, this report from Oxfam about inequality.
Yeah, absolutely. The world's 2,000 plus billionaires have more wealth than the 60% of the world's population, 4.6 billion people. Oxfam's reports, to me, are notable, not just for the numbers that they shine a light on, and they do this every year before Davos kicks off, but also for the language they use. The writer in me absolutely loves the imagery, the metaphors that they use to get their point across. They're very vivid, and they work, basically, because we can tell you the numbers. And, you know, people shrug and move on, don't they? But the images they come up with are powerful indeed. Here is two from this year's report. One is the $100 bills. The report points out that if everyone in the world was to sit on their wealth piled up in $100 bills, the majority of humanity would be sitting on the floor. A middle-class person in a rich country would be sitting at the height of a chair. And the world's two richest people, Jeff Bezos and Bernard Arnault, would be sitting in outer space.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
It is. The other example that they give, or one of the other examples that they give in this report, is of the difficulty of trying to catch up to... Not everyone aspires to be a billionaire, but basically trying to show the gulf and the futility in what faces the majority of the world. If someone saved $10,000 a day and had done since the construction of the Egyptian pyramids, they would still be 80%, 80 less wealthy than the world's five richest billionaires. That is the size of the gap. Oxfam is urging policymakers to increase taxes on the world's wealthiest people over the next decade. They've said extreme wealth is the sign of a failing economic system.
That's one of the big talking points this year at Davos. Another one is climate change. Obviously, the welfare of the planet first and foremost, but also its economic impact, its impact on financial markets. In Davos this week is Julia Chatterley. She is with CNN. She's one of their international correspondents, presents the weekly program, the daily program, the New York Stock Exchange on CNN International. And she says that the big story this year is going to be about two people, very contrasting personalities at Davos. One is the US President Donald Trump, and the other is the teenage activist Greta Thunberg.
Oh, that's an easy one. The real headline is this year, US President Donald Trump versus 17-year-old activist Greta Thunberg. If you want to put the climate crisis at the top of the agenda here in terms of debate, then who better than those two as sparring partners here? We all remember Greta's pleading at the UN meetings last year and the belief, I think, from Donald Trump and the US administration that perhaps the focus is misplaced at this stage. That, well and truly, will take a lot of focus this year as well, never mind what's going on back in the United States with the impeachment trials kicking off this week too. What's also, I think, going to be noticeable here this year is who doesn't come. Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, not going to turn up. Of course, he's working on getting the UK out of the EU by the 31st of January. There will be plenty of innovators, plenty of focus on technologies of the future, automation, artificial intelligence, health as well. The joy for me about coming to Davos, it's the things that you learn outside of the things that we debate on a daily basis. It's always great for those conversations.
Is it though? This is the question. Davos this year is in its anniversary year. It's its 50th year. And some real questions being asked now about whether 3,000 odd politicians, celebrities and journalists turning up to a tiny mountain town, over 100 of them in private jets, is really the way to tackle some of the world's problems, particularly when, as you say, those two big issues are inequality and climate change.
Well, Klaus Schwab has been defending Davos itself. It's the 50th edition of Davos, so something of a celebration. He says they're not going to be having a party to celebrate 50 years, but he says...
They've got chocolates with their logo on them. I'm looking at them now. Embossed. Not even a little sticker on the top of it. Embossed chocolates.
He says, and we're going to hear from him now, that the big thing they're celebrating is... The real value of Davos, he says, is to bring together what he calls stakeholders, which is a bit kind of jargony, but he says that's what it's been doing for 50 years. You may not like the fact that these billionaires and world leaders are all gathering in one place together, but they are the people who make decisions that do affect the billions living on this planet. And you may like that, you may not like it, but they do. And getting them in the same ski resort together is important. This is him. I'll let you have your say in a second, but this is him, Klaus Schwab, founder, Professor Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum, defending the concept of Davos.
I wanted to create a place where stakeholders could meet, and that was the original idea of Davos. So I'm very pleased and happy that we are not only celebrating 50 years, but we are celebrating now, finally, that stakeholder capitalism has become or is becoming mainstream.
Is it?
He says it is. He would point to the fact that, as well as billionaires and world leaders, and of course Donald Trump is all of the above, you have got Greta Thunberg is there. She was giving a speech in Lausanne in Switzerland a couple of days ago. She's going to be there. You've got, for example, in terms of celebrities, Deepika Padukone, the Bollywood actress, is going to be there as well. And she's becoming a very vocal activist on social issues in her native India and elsewhere as well. So that, when he talks about stakeholders, the point he's making is it's not just billionaires and world leaders.
My question, I guess, is this, particularly when it comes to the different sessions trying to tackle inequality. It's all very well talking about upskilling and ways to tackle inequality. Someone has to pay for a lot of the programs that are going to do that. And does that mean that the world's richest people, and I know one or two of them have come forward and said, yes, we would like to pay more tax, I should be paying more tax. And also the world's richest companies, because it's one thing for one individual to say, yeah, actually, I'm going to give away a load of my money. That's nice. What is your giant global conglomerate doing in the way of tax? That, I mean, money where your mouth is, I think, is what we need to see more than platitudes and discussion forums and breakout sessions.
Now, staying with economics, let's hear from Shadi Al-Borno. He's the head of macro strategy at Emirates NPD. We've been asking him about some of the big economic stories of the day, including, not Brexit, but Megxit. Meghan and Harry quitting the UK royal family for whatever reason. It is a big story on the front and back, indeed, the pink pages of the world's newspapers. This is Shadi Al-Borno on Megxit and the impact on the British economy.
It's too early to call the impact of Megxit on the British economy. It is estimated, according to Brand Finance, that the royal family generates income of about £1.8 billion a year and have a brand value worth of about $88 billion, which is relatively enormous. So it'll be interesting to see as this pans out what kind of a real impact that would have on the British tourism sector.
Fascinating economic insights from Shadi Al-Borno of Emirates NPD there. There is an economic story. We are allowed to talk about it.
There you go. And good on Shadi. I have to say, we sit down every morning and we look at the topics we're going to discuss with Emirates NPD. I threw that one in as a bit of a joke to make him smile. And he answered it. I'm so impressed.
Thanks for your messages coming in on the very serious issue of inequality, which is front and centre at the World Economic Forum in Davos this year. Henk writes in saying extreme wealth might be a sign of a failing system, but without the billionaire Bill Gates, we would still have polio worldwide. Thanks very much indeed, Henk. And someone else writes in saying using Jeff Bezos as an example of inequality is ridiculous. He created Amazon. Most of his wealth is in shares, not cash and disposable money. It undermines the argument to use the wrong examples. Not necessarily saying we endorse those views, but thank you very much indeed for sharing them.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
It's a real pleasure to welcome into the Dubai Eye studio an old friend of the Business Breakfast, the Chief Investment Officer for Standard Chartered Private Bank, based in Singapore, but here in Dubai, Steve Bryce. Morning, Steve.
Good morning, Richard.
Nice to see you. Let's talk about where we should be putting our hard-earned savings at the moment. And your bigger picture idea surprises me. Global stock markets have had one heck of a run lately. To me, the valuations look quite top-heavy. But you say you are overweight global equities. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, there is a risk that we could see a short-term pullback. So they do look a little bit overextended. But from a valuation perspective, it really matters whether you look at it on an absolute basis relative to history or to other asset classes. So if you look at the US stock market, for instance, that's usually where people focus when they talk about valuations being a bit extended. They are expensive relative to long-term history, but relative to bonds, they're still actually pretty cheap. So if you look at the earnings yield that you get on equities relative to the bond yield you could get from investing in, say, US Treasury market, that is still pretty wide. So a relative perspective means that people, I mean, it's really that there is no alternative. TINA sort of type investments, you're saying, okay, I'm being forced to take...
TINA.
Yeah, there is no alternative.
I like that. I'm going to steal that one.
Okay, so people are effectively, by very loose monetary policies, very low bond yields, being forced into other asset classes to take more risk to achieve their financial objectives.
So within US equities, I know you're not going to say buy Amazon and sell Apple, but are there any themes within the US stock market that you can point to us?
So from a sector perspective, we're overweight financials. So we think the economy is going to stabilize. Obviously, there was a concern about recession last year. We're expecting that to stabilize and improve. We had obviously had good housing starts data on Friday, which is a leading indicator of consumer spending. So that's coming through. We're expecting the yield curve to steepen a little bit, which is generally good for the banks as well. So financials is actually a theme for us both in the US and Europe, and it's very critical from a Europe perspective.
You also say that Europe in particular is somewhere you're overweight. You like European stocks. You like European banks. You even like the euro currency.
Yeah, so if we look at, actually the banks is pretty critical for the euro area view. So if euro area banks are outperforming domestically, that's usually pretty well correlated with the market outperforming global equities. Now, our sense here is that we're seeing a strong credit impulse coming through in Europe, which usually leads growth by around 6 to 12 months. Obviously, again, we're sort of saying the ECB has obviously got negative interest rates, but it has mitigated the impact on the banks. And the banks are incredibly cheap, both on an absolute basis, price to book around 0.7, but also relative to the market. The gap between either on a price earnings ratio basis or a price book ratio basis, the gap is incredibly wide relative to history. So we think the banks can play catch up, and that should drive the market higher in relative terms.
Other things that you're looking at the moment are gold. You like gold at the moment.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, actually. When I was here a year ago, we were talking very bullishly about oil, and I think we hit our target within the first month or two of the year. Gold's done the same for us this year. So we had a 1610 target. We hit that target on January 8th. So we are still bullish on gold, but we're looking for dips to buy it. So maybe around 1515, 1530. If we get down there, that's where we'd be buying gold. And that's largely as a hedge against that overweight equities. On geopolitical risk, mainly actually the US election is where we're mostly concerned there.
Let's talk about risk. You mentioned there that last year the world was preoccupied with whether or not we would see a global recession. Has that fear completely gone away? Where are the potential headwinds?
So far, yes, they seem to have gone away. I think, if we look at the three ways an economy generally goes into recession, it's either overheating, so inflation picking up, so the Fed has to tighten. We seem to be a long way away from that at the moment. Inflation expectations are still very benign. You get an external shock, which is obviously incredibly difficult to predict, or you get financial imbalances. And you're starting to see some of that coming through, to be honest. I think the one area that we are concerned about is the corporate debt market. So a lot of leverage in the corporate space. Share buybacks in the US are being funded a lot by debt. That's exacerbating the situation. So that's where we're watching. We just don't think that's necessarily going to be an issue for 2020, but at some point it will be.
Let's talk about two big themes that we're covering this morning on the Business Breakfast. The first one is inequality. You'll have seen the Oxfam report that came out this morning, always does, ahead of the World Economic Forum in Davos. 2,153 people, billionaires, have as much wealth as the bottom 60%, 4.5 billion people. How do you factor that, not just emotionally, but how do you factor that financially into your forecasts?
I think it's really difficult. So we generally look 12 months forward. So from that perspective, these things are in the background and happening. But anything that could lead to an acceleration of addressing those imbalances obviously would be extremely good from an economic growth and reduced inequality perspective, but could be bad for corporate profitability. So I think the US election is going to be really interesting in this regard. Because on the Democratic side, you've got Bernie Sanders doing obviously very well in the polls, not yet overtaking Biden, but he's obviously got some policy prescriptions that could be quite damaging for markets. So that's where the way we're pitching it from an equity market perspective is saying the first half is probably going to be good, depending on who the Democratic candidate is and whether they can really truly rival Trump. Then we could see more volatility in the second half of the year.
The other theme that we're looking at, and this will come up at Davos again, is climate change and the impact. Again, the impact it could have on the world is clearly the bigger picture issue, but you're the chief investment officer, so the impact it could have on our investment. I'm going to ask you your thoughts on that. But first of all, this is Greta Thunberg. She's going to Davos this week, but this was her speaking a couple of days ago at a rally in Switzerland.
I am so grateful to be here with you, especially now on the anniversary of the strike in Lausanne. And I am so thankful that all of you showed up today with your beautiful faces. We are now in a new year and we have entered a new decade. And so far during this decade, we have seen no signs whatsoever that real climate action is coming. And that has to change.
How do you factor that into your forecast, Steve?
Obviously, we've seen significant progress, I think, for a lot of companies trying to address this. But is it too little, too late? Is the biggest concern, of course. Really, the way we look at this is from an investment perspective, we're getting increased focus on ESG type funds.
Just remind us what ESG is.
So, environmental, social, and governance related. So. That is a shift that's definitely taking place. All the private banks, asset managers are very focused on this and investors. I think investors historically have been very Western based in looking at ESG, but we're starting to see more of that coming through in Asia as well. And that can lead to outperformance as well. So it's not just a nice to have green, soft and fuzzy feeling, but actually, you do see outperformance of many ESG funds. So from that perspective, we're still, that's a big focus for us.
Do you also factor in climate now into your risks? I mean, the new big report that's come out from the WEF reckons that over half the world's GDP is at risk of climate shock. What we've seen happen in Australia will absolutely have an impact on the Australian economy. Are you having to build that into your forecasts?
I think at the top-down level, probably it's really difficult to do so because you don't know when something's going to hit. And obviously in the situation of Australia, these things are going to be of increasing frequency, but you can't actually predict when they're going to happen. What you can do is when you look at individual stocks, you can try and understand how the company is trying to address these concerns, where its major risks are, and what is the probability at some point of those hitting. So, yes, I think at the individual stock level, it's very important.
Finally, quick word on local stocks. You've lived here in Dubai previously. You watched them closely. Since last we spoke, we've had the big Aramco IPO. I know you don't give stock tips, but in terms of Middle East markets as an asset class, how are you reading those?
Yeah, obviously, from an international investor, obviously the markets are still fairly small. Obviously, Saudi is now becoming bigger, of course, because of the Saudi Aramco IPO. I think the way we look at this, just from an outsider looking in these days, is we're looking for the oil prices to stay pretty much around where we are. We're looking for the dollar to weaken 5 to 7% globally. Those are conditions where, if anything, it should be positive for the environment in the Middle East and the GCC countries generally. I think it's going to be slightly better outlook rather than, we're talking to people in Dubai, people are still pretty concerned about how things are going. But I think overall, the environment's likely to improve.
Steve Bryce, great talk to you. Appreciate you joining us this morning. Chief Investment Officer of Standard Chartered Private Bank. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Maria Boutros from the Area News Centre with us in the studio. Morning, Maria.
Good morning.
And continuing Brandy's trend last week of putting walk-on music for you.
Maria, I've just kissed a girl named Maria.
Which, of course, I didn't. But
yes, my fiancé would not like that.
It's all above board. Joking apart, tell us the stories you've got today. It's about space travel.
Okay, so locally a lot has been happening, but I'll mention one of our top stories, which is that Emiratis can still send in their applications for the second UAE astronaut program. So they announced in December that they're looking for the second batch of UAE astronauts. And ever since then, they've received tons of applications from both male and female Emiratis. That's when the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center decided to extend the deadline until March 31st to give others a chance to apply. So, of course, the same criteria applies. They must be Emirati. They must be 18 years old or above. And they should be fluent in both Arabic and English. And finally, they need to be university graduates. So they must have a bachelor's degree or higher.
And then you're going to end up learning to speak Russian.
Yeah.
We actually, Maria, last week were eating the space food, the Emirati space food.
Yes.
When we were at the launch of the Dubai Press Club and His Highness Sheikh Mohammed was there, they had nice snacks, but they also had some space food, which
nice.
Looks to me like cat food.
What, were they in tubes?
Like, what? Yeah.
Yeah?
Have you had it?
No, I just see them in movies all the time, so I'm like...
They had some in a tin and some in a tube. I had the tube stuff.
They did, and it was traditional Emirati recipes that had been adapted to space, wasn't it? You have to take a lot of... It's condensing, as I understand it. You need to... Because every kilogram counts mm-hmm. in space. You need to effectively take the water out of it, which is why it ends up in tubes.
But then is it dry?
What it is... No, it's not dry. It's like paste.
It's like pesto, yeah.
So there was... What Richard was eating was bala... And I'm going to get the names here wrong, and I apologise. Balalit,
yes.
So you've got the egg omelette with vermicelli.
Mm-hmm.
Saluna, which was what I think was in the tin...
Yeah,
by the look of it, and what was in the tube that looked kind of like an old fashioned sort of meat paste.
Whiskers
was not whiskers. It was madruba, which is I think is it the chicken and the oats that have been cooked together.
Yeah,
and then a lot of the water is sucked out of it, which is what makes it spacey. Effectively, that's what happens to the freeze dried ice cream. You know, when kids learn about space, it's always to do with freeze dried.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ice cream mm-hmm. is that you want to take the heaviest component out, which is the water.
True.
It was perfectly pleasant. Had it been served up in a 5-star restaurant
on a cracker.
And I thought, oh, that's lovely. That's an interesting textures.
Pate would probably be the best analogy.
Yeah. True.
Astronauts needed by the local authorities. Also, Maria, other stories you're looking at.
Okay, so next up in regional news, Saudi Arabia seems to be attracting more international companies. According to the Investment Highlights Winter 2020 report by the Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority, more than 1,130 international companies set up operations in 2019. Now, if we compare that number to 2018, that's a 54% increase. We also see a dramatic increase in India's market as well, from 30 companies established in 2018 to 140 in 2019. According to the report, this was driven by the high-profile royal visits to the country in February last year. Among the other top countries represented in the report are Egypt, Jordan, and China.
Not surprising, given how much is happening there.
Yeah.
Maria, thank you very much indeed. Brandy Scott, one of your top stories this morning has been the 20th anniversary of Vox Cinemas, but more importantly, looking at the next 20 years and innovation in the cinema industry. We'll get on, Maria, to Brandy's ridiculous idea about innovation
it's
in
brilliant.
Cinemas that's been completely shot down by the guys at Vox, thankfully. We'll get to that in a second.
I feel I can reopen that door.
That door will be reopened in a second. But first of all, it got us thinking about our favourite movies of the past 20 years. Mine was this one.
Your file shows no kills, Bond. But to become a 00, it takes two.
That's Casino Royale, which was the first Daniel Craig Bond movie. Came out in 2006, almost 15 years ago. Daniel Craig's final Bond movie comes out in just a couple of weeks' time. But it really reset the Bond genre, which had become a little bit kind of Dairy Milk chocolate box under Pierce
Brosnan.
Fluffy
hair.
Yeah. Good
hair. Wide-lapelled jackets. No, it needed it. If you read the original Bond books, he was a bit of a thug. I mean, that's the way he was portrayed in the... in the novels, in Ian Fleming's books. And I thought Daniel Craig, I think, just really, really worked for me as a Bond. He looks like he could hurt you.
Brandy's movie is this.
The other kids make fun of him because of how young he looks. Nobody includes him. They call him the narc behind his back.
They do?
One day.
Which just snuck in because it came out in 2000, but we'll give you that one.
It's a charming movie. It's one of my favourite feel-good movies. You'll have a bit of a cry as well. It is almost famous. The Cameron Crowe movie. It's got Frances McDormand in it of Fargo. It's got Kate Hudson in it. About a boy who wants to be a rock reporter for Rolling Stone and ends up basically finagling his way onto tour by a band that, and people, there's been a lot of speculation as to which bands that it would be based on, because Crowe himself, Cameron Crowe, wrote for Rolling Stone when he was a teenager, and he toured with Led Zeppelin, he toured with Lynyrd Skynyrd, he toured with the Eagles. It's just a really lovely coming of age film, and the soundtrack is brilliant.
But Maria, the token millennial in the room, has gone for something a little bit more recent.
Well, this is a fun group. Welcome to detention. Spencer, Bethany, Fridge, Martha. You're all here for a reason.
Hey, person walking!
You should be thinking about who you are and who you want to be.
And the movie is?
Jumanji, but the first one, which is Welcome to the Jungle.
Up there with those Oscar classics.
Guys, I just want a good laugh. Like, when I go see a movie, I just want to laugh, so... Yeah,
I'm kind of with you, because on the way in this morning, I was thinking about this and thinking I should really try and sound vaguely intelligent and clever. And I did really enjoy Selma, the movie about Martin Luther King. And I did really enjoy An Inconvenient Truth, the Al Gore documentary about climate change. But yeah, I want my popcorn. And you can't have popcorn when you're watching those.
Yeah.
That shows. Exactly. Bond movie, Jumanji. I'm
with you. In my cinema of the future, There will be no popcorn.
There will be no popcorn.
There will be treadmills. Because this was the idea that I pitched to the guys at Vox this morning. The idea, hear me out here, I figure we've all feel guilty about sitting down, right? You settle down all day at your desk, go to the movies, sit down again for another 90 minutes to 2 hours. If you took a movie theatre, you filled it full of treadmills, they'd have to be staged, right? They'd have to be on different tiers so that you could see. And maybe you would need like some kind of like fantastic headphones, because treadmills are noisy, that you could watch the film whilst working out. You could even have exercise bikes in a special row in the back. 90
like
minutes,
it.
You could walk, you could jog a bit, you could stand and lean if you just wanted to use it as kind of like a standing desk. People could be bringing you water.
I love it. I don't know what you're on about, Richard. I love
guilt-free,
it.
Guilt-free cinema viewing. And wouldn't those 90 minutes of your brisk walk go faster if you were watching a Bond film?
Well, Brandy pitched the idea to Michelle this morning and this was her response.
I would be lying if I said we haven't thought about it. We have sat down in ideation sessions at the beginning of every year and we think, well, what can we do differently? And it was an idea that came up a couple of years ago. Never got off the ground, but I may have to go back and rethink that approach.
See, Richard thinks that I was blown off there. Did you hear the last comment? Go back and think about it.
Exactly. And they thought about it initially, which means it's a good idea.
See?
I support it.
I think it's brilliant. Brilliant.
Not coming to a cinema near you anytime soon. I can just see what's going to happen. She's going to have the guys from like Real Cinemas in next week pitching it to them. Then we'll have Novo in. Then we'll have the Roxy until someone just says, oh, all right then, fair enough.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
We're talking family businesses.
It's a family affair. It's a family affair. It's a family affair.
And that's because the UAE Cabinet has approved a draft law that's going to allow family-owned companies to list on UAE stock markets. Joining us in the studio to give us some perspective on this is Bob Coley, Managing Director of RTS Global Partners, which is a family business advisory company. Morning, Bob. Good to see you.
Good to see you guys.
So as far as I know, in the past 22 years of living here, there's been nothing to stop family businesses listing on the local stock market. They just haven't wanted to. So what's new in this legislation?
Well, actually, so there are certain family businesses over here that are under the agency law, which governs, you know, specific agencies like automotive agencies, chemical agencies, right, electronics agencies. So there's a lot of family businesses that fall under that umbrella. And according to the agency law, all of those family businesses must be 100% UAE owned. And therefore, they are actually restricted from accessing capital markets. So what this law, in effect, is doing is it's removing that hurdle for these companies to be able to access those capital markets, to be able to raise funds and grow.
So we could then potentially see Alpha Thames Toyota distribution business or Altair's Ford distribution business and so on listed on the Dubai financial market.
That's exactly the point. I think the government has always had a very keen interest in allowing these family businesses to be able to modernize their structures, to be able to diversify their assets, to be able to, you know, institute good governance processes and systems, and then raise funds either on the public markets or in the private markets. I think what this law is doing is it's encouraging more of them to get out there. Many of them hesitate. Many family businesses actually are not very keen to go out to capital markets. But I think this is a good law that's removing at least one of the bottlenecks that's in place.
Which is my question about what is the appetite for this to raise funds like this publicly? And what would increase that appetite?
I think with a lot of family businesses, there's two factors that come into play when they're looking at raising funds, either through public or private markets. One of them is, you know, on more of the harder side, it is about financial transparency. You know, I've had a lot of control on my business in terms of ownership, in terms of management, and now I don't want to let go of that control. I don't want to have public scrutiny if I'm going to be listed publicly. And so I think on that side, a lot of families actually are not very keen on taking on public capital. But at the same time, I think there's also a softer element to this, which is about identity. A lot of these family businesses are about the identity, are about the legacy. And when you go out into the capital markets, I think there is a big fear that, you know, what's going to happen to that identity? What's going to happen to the legacy? What's going to happen to the next generation? Am I going to lose control of all of this? So there's a fear factor in there. I think what can change the appetite, to be honest, is a lot of education. I think the government has done a great job with this law in terms of getting out there and removing the hurdles. But I think more needs to be done on educating family businesses that, you know, raising capital, improving your governance systems, ensuring that the family is aligned, speaking with one voice out there, you know, representing one voice and not having conflicts get in the way. I think that's a key thing that government has to play a role in as well.
Is there an appetite amongst investors for this?
To be honest, so one of the key factors when investors invest in any company, right? So if I'm talking about private investors, but I think public investors would be the same, is that, you know, yes, do I like the business model? Yes, do I like the strategy? Yes, do I like the products? But it's also about, does the culture fit with me? You know, am I going to invest in this company only to find out that culturally there's major, issues in there? And I think what basically family businesses need to pay attention to when raising either public or private capital is actually improving the culture, is ensuring that they are aligned decision-making, alignment towards succession, good vision, good strategy, so on.
What about what they actually do, though? Because a lot of these family businesses are agencies for other businesses.
Right.
As an investor, wouldn't I rather invest in the primary business rather than the local agency?
Well, right now the agency law requires that any agencies have to be 100% UAE owned. Or this draft law basically says if it's not 100% UAE owned, it can be publicly listed. So as an investor, I have the option to either invest in this, but investing directly in the company means not investing here. It would mean investing externally.
I remember speaking a while ago now to Naguib Sawiris. I think it was one of the Sawiris brothers, the Egyptian billionaires.
Yep.
About listing on the stock market. And many of their companies are listed on the stock market. And he said, I would warn any family business to think very, very hard about doing this. He said, I remember the quote, it was hard enough when me and my brothers had to agree on making a decision. Try doing that when you got thousands of shareholders.
Yes.
And lots of 26-year-old analysts writing buy-sell-hold recommendations on you. So he gave a very stark warning. He didn't say don't do it, but he said think twice before doing it. On the flip side, you see, particularly in Saudi Arabia, a handful of family businesses have successfully listed part or all of their companies on the stock market. The Allianz are one example that's often held up, but there are others. Give us some successful case studies that can perhaps inspire others.
Well, one case study, I mean, you guys were talking about NMC this morning for different reasons, but I think one success story is what they did with Finabler in terms of they went through an approach of consolidating all of their financial assets in terms of UAE Exchange, TravelX, those companies into one umbrella. So there was a structuring process that went on over there, adding the right type of governance processes as well on top of that to ensure that, again, the shareholders are all aligned and speaking with one voice to the public markets. And then they listed on the London Stock Exchange. So I think that definitely is a good case study. But that said, absolutely, there is, you know, one of the things that one investor once told me was that if I'm investing in a family business, the first thing I need to know is, am I speaking to one person or am I speaking to the entire family? Am I going to get in there and get involved with honestly managing differences between them? Or are they actually, do they have their act together? And I think that's basically the warning that you heard from the Egyptian brothers is that in the end, it's hard enough sometimes within families to agree amongst one another. You get the financial analysts involved, and that just throws a whole nother problem into the situation.
30 seconds there. We're almost out of time. Sure. Prediction, get your crystal ball out.
Yeah.
When are we going to see one of the big name family businesses here in the UAE listing on a stock market, either Dubai or Abu Dhabi?
I would probably say somewhere between the 18 to 24 months. I would see probably one of the big agency firms getting out there and listing. It's going to take time, not just to, you know, they might already have the intention to do it, but it's going to take time to get, again, all the structures in place, all the governance in place, and to ensure that they're meeting minimum threshold to be able to list on the markets.
Bob Coley, Managing Partner, RTS Global Partners. Appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Rich and I will be back in the studio tomorrow morning, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.